Just for the benefit of, we're going to post this online so folks can listen in later, just for the benefit, where this is docket 14-35-140. This is the technical conference the Pacific Corp present on regarding queue management and power purchase agreement milestones. I'm Jordan White, Commission Counsel, and I'm going to go ahead and turn the time over to Brian Dickman with Pacific Corp, who's going to guide us on this presentation.
Okay. To make sure everybody in the room has the slide deck for this afternoon. All right, so the title of it is Utah Schedule 38 Pricing Queue Management PPA Milestone.
And this was also posted on the docket website, too, just for those who are tuning in later.
Okay, very good. So, as Jordan mentioned, I'm Brian Dickman. I'm the manager of net power costs for Pacific Corp. And the management of the pricing queue for qualifying facilities is kind of a team effort between my group and the origination group. So Bruce Griswold, who's here, is going to help out with the presentation today and talk about our process and kind of what we do to manage the queue. The slides, starting on page number 2, first provide some context for the discussion. For those of you that may not be intimately familiar with this issue, so some background, if you'll humor us. The Schedule 38 prices, as most of you know, are calculated using the proxy partial displacement differential revenue requirement, PVDRR. And the reason that's relevant for today is the method uses a differential revenue requirement for all years of a QF PPA, but it switches over to also deferring or including avoided capacity costs of a proxy resource in the deficiency period. So the pricing is split into a resource sufficiency and deficiency period, and the avoided capacity costs are included in the price for a QF according to the schedule of deferrable resources in the IRP, the Integrated Resource Plan. So this slide 2, we've provided a table to show that schedule from our most recent IRP, the 2013 IRP update. So kind of gives you an idea of what we're looking at. The next deferrable resource in the IRP update is a combined cycle combustion turbine plant coming online in 2027. It's the 423 megawatt plant there. And we've also provided a location, so you can see that it's planned for the east side of our system. Clover is the bubble, the topology bubble, where we place it in the grid model. We kind of talked about that this morning. So you can see the schedule. There's 6 combined cycle combustion turbines included in the preferred portfolio in the 2013 IRP update. You can see the schedule that they come online. Again, relevant because a QF, the first QF in the door, or the first QF in the queue, would partially displace the first combined cycle. So it would start receiving capacity payments in 2027, or I guess the capacity costs would be built into the avoided cost prices in 2027. And then we continue to partially displace that combined cycle, and then the next combined cycle, and the next, and so on, as the queue of pricing requests grows. And so it'll continue to push out that payment capacity. The next slide, page 3, shows you the list of signed QF PPAs that were executed since the IRP was put together. This is the beginning of the QF pricing queue, because our grid model, the study that's used to compute the avoided cost prices, includes the resources that are from the IRP, and so anything that was executed since that IRP was put together, we have to put into our study as well. So these are the signed QFs. You can see there's 16 of them. And by the way, this table comes from our latest filed quarterly compliance filing. So this is from the Q3 2014 compliance filing.
These are new the latest PPAs that have been signed, or
These are new since the IRP was put together.
The update or the original?
The update.
That's why you don't see Blue Mountain Wind or Matador Wind on here.
That is correct.
They existed at the time of the IRP update.
That's correct. They were included in the modeling of the IRP update. That's right. And so if you look at the grid study used for calculating the avoided cost, they're also in there. They're just not called out as in the queue, in air quotes there.
So just on that table, so it shows the nameplate in the second column, and in the first column it shows partial displacement. And that partial displacement is based on the 84% capacity contribution that was ordered by the commission for the solar tracking, and the 68% for the fixed tilt. So that's why the partial displacement is slightly less than the nameplate.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. In fact, you can see that in the column, second column to the end, from the end, has the capacity contribution for each of the contracts. And you'll see that the wind QFs have a 20.5% capacity contribution. So those are the numbers from the 12035-100 docket.
Your proposal will change those to the numbers we discussed this morning.
Yes. Right. Yes. Once that's rolled into this into the avoided cost prices, yes, we would apply the new capacity contribution percentages to all of these projects in the queue to come up with a revised partial displacement.
Yeah. So while the partial displacement amount is less, it also has a impact on the queue displacement. So there's a smaller amount of queue displacement. So they're a bit offsetting as you put those two together.
Mm-hmm. And note, this is system-wide. These are not just Utah projects.
If these are already signed, will these numbers changed? You know, because will their pricing be already fixed?
The pricing is fixed, right? So we're not.
But the contribution does.
That's correct.
Change?
So the contribution that's assumed in the grid model used to price the next QF will change, and that's relevant to, as Greg mentioned, these will count less towards deferring capacity, shortening the queue for the next QF that comes in the door. So the next slide, page 4, this is the rest of the pricing queue. These are all of the not yet executed requests for prices that have come in the door. All the same concepts apply. So it's you can see we've masked the names, but it shows the nameplate capacity, capacity factor, capacity contribution of each, and the proposed start date. So all of these are also impacted by the assumed capacity contribution.
I have a question.
Yes.
So as immediately after they get into the queue, they start displacing capacity for the next person.
So. Correct. The next
regardless
request
of where they
in
are
the door,
in the development.
That is true. The next request in the door would be placed at the very end of this, it'd be number 45 or whatever, at the very end of the table. And so you can see that there's, in the partial displacement column at the very bottom, you can see there's the total partial displacement is 2,070 megawatts. Right, so the next queue up in the door, there would be 2,000 megawatts in front of them that's displacing capacity. And for reference, you can go back to that slide number 2, and see that that would place their avoided capacity kind of in the middle of the second 2030 combined cycle. There's that cumulative capacity there of those new resources. Yeah, so the next QF would start avoiding capacity costs in 2030.
So a QF takes a spot in the queue when you give them indicative pricing, is that right? when they make the request.
So we'll get into more specific details as we go here, but yet they get placed in the queue on a first-come, first-served basis as they request it.
As they request it.
Yeah.
As they request pricing, or...
So we'll clear up all those, exactly when they would be placed in. But generally speaking, first come, first serve, as they request prices, they go into the queue. And then we start calculating those prices in that order. So I think that covers the content there. Any other questions on those slides so far? I guess I'll just, one other thing to point out is in the details of this table, it does have the start date. So to the extent, most of these are start pretty quickly. They come, that's the online date of each of those contracts. So they go into the model as they come online as well. So that's, I guess, an important distinction to make. If the next QF, there's displacement. Well, I'll just leave it at that. So everybody comes in as they're scheduled to come online, but then the cumulative capacity is used to displace the IRP resources. All right, so slide 5, I'll turn over to Bruce, and this gets into some of the details of exactly how they make it into the queue and get prices calculated.
Thanks, Brian. So my name is Bruce Griffith. Director in the origination department in home trade in Portland. The origination group, as it relates to this, manages all of the QF contracts across our system, from the negotiation questions to the company through the website for QFs that. You go call that number, I would answer the phone if I was sitting at the desk. So what I want to do is kind of walk through the pricing and queue management. And it's, as Brian said, it's kind of a combined effort in that we have QFs that make the requests into origination. We go through kind of a series of exchanges back and forth with the QF to ensure we have all the information we need, and then it's placed with Brian, which at that point they put it into the queue, and it starts the clock on getting the pricing done. But there are a few points I just wanted to kind of highlight, because that was the 30-second description, but a few points here to talk about. Primarily, this is an independent from Pacific Core Transmission interconnection or transmission services queue. You can go on to the PacTrans OASIS website. You can pull down the interconnection queue, and you can see where those, because all of that is very public, you can see where all of the projects are in their interconnection process. If they've got a system impact study, that's available publicly to look at. When it comes time to get to acquire transmission service, whether it's the company securing merchant side securing network transmission for the resource, or just anybody trying to secure it, you can pull that queue down. It's basically a spreadsheet, and you can see what the order is there for transmission services. The pricing queue is completely separate from that. The pricing queue is really meant to establish the order in which the company has received requests for indicative pricing, and then get those in line so that Brian can generate the prices, and then we would provide those back to the QF. We maintain a list of all of the project contacts, the requests, kind of status of any negotiations or kind of status of what's going on relative to the project. Net Power Cost maintains pretty much the same list, but theirs is in the order in which they've received them for preparing the pricing and for displacing of whatever resources out there in the future. As we said, Brian, Brian said that the requests are done on a first-come, first-serve basis. We generally, if you know Schedule 38, there's a section in there, paragraph B2, which has about 10 or 11 items of information that the company requests in writing so that we can, you know, define when it's coming on, the capacity of it, what the capacity factor is of it, point of delivery, just a number of items, including information we like is to get information on kind of the profile of the output of the project. And that's usually can be an hourly profile for the whole year. That's the best. The minimum is kind of a 12 by 24, where you've got a monthly profile, a profile for each month for a typical 24-hour day. The origination people, like it says here, we work with a developer to make sure we have all the information. Sometimes we'll be back and forth to make sure we have everything clarified before we submit it to the net power cost folks for pricing. And once we've confirmed that, we let the developer know, and then we've starting to see more of this, but if there's a multiple request by the same developer, in other words, they may ask, you know, they're not sure whether they're going to put a solar project there or a wind project, or they've submitted six solar projects. We get kind of a priority listing with that developer so that they know when we submit it, that's the order that they're requesting it at. Once we have all of that, we provide that to the net power cost group, and that's when kind of the clock starts per Schedule 38 to get indicative prices. Brian's folks will confirm that the data is sufficient. Occasionally, they do find something that doesn't match up. It could be, for example, the capacity factor they provided doesn't match up with the calculated capacity factor using the hourly or the 12 by 24 hour data. If that doesn't match up, we go back to the developer until we have kind of clear information on how the pricing will get done.
So just so I'm clear, so in terms of maintaining the queue, they go into the queue when you submit it for pricing to the net power cost.
Right.
So conceivably, say you've got two QFs, A and B. A submits information to you and asks for indicative pricing, and you look over that. And say there's something lacking, so you have to go back and forth a couple of times with them. QFB, in the meantime, comes in. Everything is perfect. So you go ahead and submit that to for pricing. So QFB would actually be in the queue ahead of QFA.
Yeah, that could.
Even though they initiated the process later.
Right. That could happen.
Okay.
Yeah. And part of the reason is, if it goes into pricing and it's the information is wrong, it comes back out
right,
until we
right.
get it. And it may be that there's a date wrong on the, for their COD, their point of interconnection may be different. So we really try to make sure everything's ready to get priced.
Right.
Now, we've had the occasion where we've had two that have come in, basically at the same day and both of them had good information. You in that time, you're just looking at kind of the time stamp of when you got it. So, and that has happened. For some reason, kind of the Friday of the week is when everybody comes into things. But it's. I think it's critical. We always try to look at that we have a package that can go to Brian for his pricing that doesn't get rejected out again. Yeah.
Okay. Bruce, at what point does it get taken off the queue and put into the grid model? for future, if you're looking, say, ahead a couple of years, you want to find out, you're doing a forecast grid, at what point is, what's the line of demarcation?
You mean when it's used?
Jamie, I'm not sure I understand your question.
So I'm looking at just your first chart, and I'm sorry if I don't understand.
That's okay. Oh, sorry.
On page 3, and you mentioned that Blue Mountain and Latigo are off this, and now in the grid model.
Yeah.
So what, for the next one on the list, when would Red Hills go?
Okay, so let me just be clear. All of them are in the grid model.
So they are.
Yes. Okay. So we show them in this list
to show order
To show an order since the IRP was put together. Yeah. So anything in that shows up in this list is just new since the IRP, but they all go into the grid model. Yeah. And so next time this. Red Hills will likely disappear off this list once the next IRP is published. It will have been included in the IRP.
Got it.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
Could I just ask for a refinement of something to you? I think you probably said this, but when QF goes to pricing and then there's a problem, something that you overlooked or something else that they need, whatever. So are they then out of the queue and they go back and start at the beginning?
It depends on if it's just a phone call to the developer to clarify something. Let's say their capacity factor shows, a 20% capacity factor, but their generation profile shows a 29% capacity factor. That's a significant difference. Then we would bring it out and send that back to them and ask them to update it.
So then they re-enter whenever they get their information
right.
corrected or adjusted or whatever.
Yeah. But we try to catch that more and more before it goes into them.
Right.
You know, we try to match up capacity, like for example, just the capacity factor and the profile. We try to catch all of those items as cleanly as possible, but you know it doesn't always happen. They may provide a point of interconnection that doesn't have an exact point of delivery. We probably wouldn't move them out of their queue spot, but if we called them up and they said, well, we still need to spend time talking to transmission about that, then we probably would remove them. Our goal is to kind of move them through as directly as possible. So that's kind of the first initial tranche of requests is, you know, the first project comes in, or the person who's never QF, who hasn't submitted a project before, or it's a new project. Now I want to kind of move to what happens now that they've gotten indicative prices and what transpires after that point. So we've delivered prices. We send those out to the QF in a formal letter. It shows them their full prices for the term of the agreement they're seeking. We generally provide them kind of an annual on and off peak price and then a levelized price, just so they can, because I think generally everybody tries to think in terms of what's this mean to me. And then we also provide them a full set of monthly prices for the shaping factors we use under Schedule 38. So somebody who did a 20-year deal would have a table showing 480 on and off-peak prices over the term. We provide that to them, and so they can do their modeling. We also, when we provide them the letter, basically say once here's your prices. If you have any questions, we can call us. We can review them with you. If you're ready to proceed to draft PPA, you know, please provide in, you know, writing that that's the next step you'd like to proceed with. As you would imagine, you know, with getting a lot of prices and putting them into a model and having to use that to make some business decisions, you know, you don't always get a response the next week that says, yeah, I'm ready to do my PPA. So this is, you know, kind of this is the section I want to talk about now is once they've got that, what transpires. We generally sometimes have developers come back and ask for updated prices. So it's, let's say it's moved through for 3 months and they say, well, I know that the quarterly curve has been done. Can you have give us updated prices? So if they don't have any change to the project, they stay in the same spot in the queue. So if they don't change their technology, they don't change any of the point of delivery, they don't change their term, their online date, nothing of changes, then we keep them right in the same spot. However, if they come back and say, well, I want updated prices, but this project now is going to have a 2017 start, not a 2016. Then we treat that as a new project, and we bring it back out, change that major term, and put it back through from the beginning. So as you can see here, typical changes. They're going to change. They've decided they're going to want to do a wind project instead of a solar project. They're changing it from fixed tilt to single axis tracking. They've decided that based on interconnection, they can't do 80 megawatts. They can only do 65. Their profile's changed because they've gone to, you know, different technology, and their operation date has changed. That kind of takes care of the ones who are trying to remain active and continue on, that are in continued communication with the company. Next, go ahead.
If you have, say, two, well, let's just say they're identical, to make it easy, QFs, that, you know, they're one and two on the list. So they're displacing part of that very first resource, deferrable resource. I would assume if they're identical, their pricing is going to be identical because they're displacing a portion of the same resource.
That would be true as long as you agree that their profile and all that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're identical. That's why I said not similar. They're identical.
Well,
don't complicate it.
Speaking at a very simplistic level.
Yes, yes. You know. The question I have in mind is, say the first QF says, hey, I'm going to change my project, so you're going to pull them out of the queue. Does that potentially could affect
everybody behind
everybody left in the queue, because they're all going to move up one slot. And it seems like, especially those that are on the margin, instead of the first resource, they're replacing the second resource, that type of thing. Do you go back and redo all those prices?
The simple answer would be yes. Because and that's why we, you know, later on here I'm going to talk about how often are we looking at projects. Okay. We try to look at projects every week, try to see when was the last time we talked to them. You know, ping them with an email, say, you know, anything changed, you know, where are you? You know, and really what happens is if we don't hear from them at all for 9 months, we pull them. I mean, it's just like you're not communicating with us, we're pulling you. If we hear from them and they say, no, I want to be in the queue, then, and if you've crossed over, let's say, or there's been changes to the assumptions that grid's running for the methodology, then the prices would get updated. We always try to ensure that our indicative prices are as close to the real model and assumptions are as possible. So I think in this case, and I know I saw Brian, you know, collect that one. I said, yeah, they'd be the same. There are nuances, so maybe you can address those. Yeah,
I'm sure there are.
Only
the idea is those first two projects, the one dropping out, it may not affect that second project because he's still close to where he was at in the queue. But those down lower in the queue, especially if they're on the cusp of going between, say, I can't remember the days, but the first resource versus the second resource, that may make a fairly large difference in the pricing of that queue.
Well, it certainly changes when they get a displaced capacity contribution, right?
Right. Yeah, that's the other one too. Is that when you do your quarterly updates, that could affect prices for everybody in the queue.
Correct. Right. So there's a lot of things that happen as you go through the kind of the overall negotiation process from request for pricing to execution. And, you know, I think our intent is always to try to make sure. And, you know, I will say sometimes the prices don't go down.
Right.
So you have to recognize that, you know, you're trying to be as accurate as possible to both customers and to the QF as you get to execution. So that just makes queue management a little challenging, simply because if you've got new ones coming in, you've got existing ones that are updating, you've got existing ones who are silent and, you know, not responding, you've got ones changing their project. And that's why, you know, if you look down through here, you'll see that we review everything weekly to make sure we're kind of on track with everything.
When something happens like August of 2013, when the methodology changes and the QFs and the queue have the option to request new indicative pricing under the new methodology, did queue orders stay the same for those who requested new indicative pricing, or were the new requests reorder the queue?
Well, I think the queue stayed the same.
Yeah, we followed these same rules, and so generally to that question, if it's just the model has changed, and so we need to get out new prices, the queue order would stay the same.
And what we did in that instance, we sent a letter to everyone who was in the queue and said, pursuant to Schedule 38, the pricing methodology has changed, and we will be sending you new prices. And then we kept the queue the same and just recalculated new prices for everyone and sent them out in that order.
Thanks.
Can I ask you another question quickly about that? We get quarterly updates on the pricing coming out of the model. Do you send out new pricing to everyone in the queue and any other set schedule, so quarterly or annually or something like that?
So when we have a project that crosses over that quarterly update, or let's say there's been a major change in assumptions in there, so there's kind of a new update there. We don't automatically update everybody's prices because that would, Ryan wouldn't, he would probably do something really bad to my office. But what we do is recognize the next time we have conversation with the list of projects is that we'll let them know that they've crossed over 3 months or whatever, and we're going to try to update their prices, as let's say we're in negotiations on the agreement and we're exchanging drafts or something like that. We'll let them know we're going to update it while we continue working on the language in the contract.
Okay.
Let's see. So removal of a project is really done kind of on two levels. One, if the project notifies us that they're withdrawing the project from pricing, or
really no communication for 9 months. And so within that 9 month period, we may ping them, and if we don't get anything for 9 months, we just assume that they're no longer working on the project. For those projects that have been removed or dropped out of their own accord, they can always come back and request pricing. And they would just be moved in to the bottom of the queue, and we would start all over with them. And as I mentioned before, we review the projects pretty much every week. And we're always going back and forth to make sure that the list of projects are as accurate as possible. Are there any that are sufficiently stale that need to be contacted and let known that prices are, that assumptions for prices have changed? And, you know, it's an ongoing effort to do that. We have, from an information standpoint, there are four originators that work on these. You know, we kind of have, because we have Utah, but we have a whole bunch of other states too. So, and each one's got a little bit different methodology. So, you know, we have originators kind of assigned to, different areas to cover different types of technologies, different size projects, and you know, they all kind of, everything kind of funnels up through me to make sure we stay on track. I'm glad Paul's back working as an originator, so I'm happy to have him back and kind of carrying some of that work over here.
Yeah, it might be a good time here, Bruce, to kind of talk about the back and forth that occurs and where QFs tend to drop out. So under Schedule 38, they request a price, and they have to provide the information we talked about. They provide that information. Brian's group calculates the price. Within 30 days, we provide a price back to the QF. At that point in time, the obligation under the tariff is done until the QF does something. Under Schedule 38, at that point in time, they have to request a draft PPA. And so at that point in time, they would provide updated information about their project and say, I want a draft PPA. And within 30 days, we would provide a draft PPA back to them. At that point in time, they have to mark up the PPA or send an issues list and send it back to the company and say, I want to engage in negotiations with you. And here's my red line of the document, or here's my issues list. And then we engage in negotiations. Projects tend to stall out after each of those three milestones. Sometimes we give them a price, and then we never hear from them again. Other times we give them a price, they ask for a PPA, we give them the PPA, and then we never hear from them again. That's usually the most, one of those two steps usually weeds out the majority of them. It's the projects who want to move forward, send in an issues list or a red line document, and then we engage in negotiations. And then the back and forth becomes much more frequent until we get to an executable PPA. So that's where they kind of tend to fall into those three buckets, where they've asked for a price, but not a PPA. They've asked for a PPA, but they haven't engaged in negotiations, or we're engaged in negotiations. That's kind of the three levels we see it.
I guess at this point, this exhibit, page 6, there's a number of questions that we've had at the division, and I think the office as well. I guess the first question is why is 9 months a good period where you've had apparently absolutely no communication from the company or the prospective developer?
Well, I think, you know, part of that goes back to kind of how long does it take to develop a project. You know, the developer's got a series of prices, and they're there then using those to do a lot of things, shop around to see if one, the project's economic,
are, you know, what's it going to cost to, for the permitting, what's it going to cost for interconnection? And a lot of times what happens is the interconnection slows down their decision-making process a little bit. Because even if they put the interconnection request in at the same time as they make a request for a PPA, they get in the queue for the interconnection, and they have to then make a decision to put down a deposit, begin a study. There's a lot of work that goes there. And it could take them 6-9 months to get to a point where they know what their interconnection costs are. Frankly, I think interconnection costs tend to be the thing that ends up stopping a lot of projects, because it, you know, if it, you know, like solar is a good example, is, you know, a solar project connecting on to a distribution system, a small one can be as expensive or more expensive than one big project interconnecting at the transmission level. So there's tends to be a fairly lengthy time in there where they're trying to figure out if they're going to move forward with prices that they've gotten. They full well know that those prices are subject to being updated. We provide that in our original letter that when we provide it to them. But I think 9 months, just from our, I guess from our business experience, seems to be a reasonable time.
Okay, but you're saying,
No, I had a follow-up, but I'll wait for your follow-up.
All right, my follow-up is that in the bulletin area below that, you say you try to contact them at least every 3 months, and you're saying you send out email or...
Call them,
and presumably, especially if you call them, you're saying they don't pick up, they don't respond and say, hey, we got your email, we're still working on it. I mean, saying in the first one that you've had absolutely no communication from the developer for 9 months. I would think if they were an active, this is just my kind of knee-jerk reaction to what you're saying, I would think that a developer that was still interested would at least return your call, respond to your email, and say, hey, we're working on interconnection agreements, we're still interested.
Right.
And some kind of feedback from them to you.
It's a very small slice that doesn't do that. So maybe I can quantify it. We don't have very often where this happens. We generally have one, they withdraw the project, mm-hmm. or they ask for updated prices, or they let us know that, yes, we are still building. We are still working on it.
Well, you know, one of the things that the division has been concerned about, and we've mentioned it in our memoranda, is that an inactive project, or one that ultimately falls by the wayside, may, by holding a position in the queue, may be blocking a more potentially more viable project. And it still strikes me as a concern that you're letting someone stay in the queue for 9 months and you've had no communication at all, even if that's only rare that occurs. And my reaction would be is maybe you should rethink that a little bit. But anyway, I'll turn the time over to Michelle.
Well, and my follow-up was very similar, because it just seems to me that you're going to have in the queue somebody who got the prices and said, "Ugh, there's no way we can make this work," and they're just sitting there holding a spot, and then you've got someone else who's diligently working towards transmission interconnect. And it feels like, you know, is there a better way? And I understand the complexity. I mean, I don't understand the complexity. I understand that it is complex. And but that's, I think, that is very much, especially as I think it was Artie, you said it before, you know, where there might be a break point. So there might be a very valid QF that's just being, you know, blocked from getting a reasonable price by a bunch of projects that really are never going to go anywhere. So I think that's what all of us are you know, the frustration. And it also feels just a little less rigorous than I think we're used to, where you have, you know, very, very clear steps, because it's kind of like, well, and then, you know, I guess we'll tell them we're going to refresh our pricing. And maybe I'm just misreading, you know, your nature, that you're just laid back and that's how you talk. But it to us, we kind of like to see things more set out in stone, I guess, so that everyone receives exactly the same treatment.
Well, I think it's important to understand, and I'm speaking not in favor of doing something one particular way, because for every developer that wants the rule to be A, another one wants it to be B, because it depends on who it gouges and who it helps. But just to be clear, you don't automatically update prices. There's no specific set of requirements that says before we sign the PPA we'll update, or if 3 months has passed we'll update, or if two projects have fallen out we'll update, right? It's kind of a
That's exactly my point.
I'm confirming.
But our objective is to have the avoided cost be as accurate and as close to, well, I guess, real time when you're executing. Schedule 38 says we have the right to update.
Yeah. And your letters are very clear. You have that right. I guess I didn't want the misimpression that necessarily leads to every 3 months or every periodic period of time, or even by the time you execute, that it has been updated. Right.
So that's, I guess, our concern and question is, how do you decide? So you earlier, if I heard you correctly, said something like, sometimes you'll have a parallel path, you'll be in negotiations, but you will get refresh pricing. Other times, it sounds like you don't.
They will always get refresh prices. If we're in the middle of negotiations and you cross over the updated curves at the end of the quarter, we will update their prices. Because we're actually in negotiations with them on it. So we are clearly driving toward an executable agreement. And they understand that.
So we could anticipate then that that every agreement that we see filed at the commission would have the most recent quarterly.
That's our goal, yes. Because
I feel like that's one of the concerns we've raised, is that that hasn't been the case. And I understand there's not, you can't do it instantaneously. So so I'm not talking about those times when you file and you had 1 week earlier filed an updated price. That's not what I'm talking about. But maybe we're not being careful, but in our evaluation, or maybe.
So let's say, for example, if we're almost finished negotiating the agreement and it's still 2 weeks from the new curves, and we're basically now just assembling the final document, we've agreed on all the language. We wouldn't say, well, you have to wait until the next price change. You've basically
right.
both
met. Conversely, we will never see a QF contract filed that has 6-month-old pricing?
That has been filed already?
That on the day that it's filed, the pricing is 6 months old.
Not likely that it would be six. So we have a lot of these QFs that are every year right now. Typically, yeah. It's the end of the Q2 curve, which would happen at the end of June. So we give them pricing mid-July, we negotiate for a month or two, agree on a contract, and then we move to execution with the various management teams, you know, late in the fall, and then we execute and file. So all these contracts get filed kind of September, October, occasionally November, that are year-end contracts. Those typically would have a mid-year curve. So that would cross over a quarter, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what Bruce is Bruce and I are saying is if we negotiate a PPA and we basically have agreed on the terms and now we're moving to final management approval and signature, which sometimes takes 2 to 3 weeks, we wouldn't update the price if it crosses over a quarter at that point in time.
I was going to say, it's sometimes longer. Don't misjudge how long it may take for credit to get through a third review, legal to get through a third review, management to get through a third review after these guys have finished their work. And that's nothing they can do about it. Frustrates the heck out of developers, but that could add months to the end and cross over a time.
And
it would frustrate
in,
them to death if they redid it at that time.
Because
they got a contract ready.
But at the same time, it also thwarts the goal of having the most current avoided costs.
Which has to be weighed against the goal of making these projects doable. Because you can't just keep updating them just because it crosses the 3 month line and then making the, it may be perhaps uneconomic.
Yeah, and I would just, I'd correct that slightly, Gary, not to put words in your mouth, but say whether it's doable now is irrelevant, but to give a QF project the ability to contract with the company if they're able to. Meaning, so we need to balance giving a QF a price that they can rely on to arrange the other aspects of development under a reasonable time period with providing an updated avoided cost.
That's
and it's a balancing act, right? So if we update every quarter and the QF has to constantly redo their economics, revisit with their lenders, revisit the BLM, whatever it may be, that might not be enough time. But do they need a year and a half to do that? No. So the intent is not for you to maintain, the Q is not for you to reserve a price and then go arrange everything else over the next 2 years. You need to have your project close enough where you can get a price and then complete development in a reasonable time period. And I would agree there has been, I don't want to say there's been subjectivity, but we try to be reasonable in balancing those two things where we say if you're a viable project and the price works for you, we want to give you time to complete the contracting process. But at the same time, you can't just hold your spot in line while you arrange everything else. And if it gets outside the bound of what we found is reasonable, then we would reprice them or move them out of the queue. Now, I know you've been pushing and the division's been pushing for more concrete dates. We're not opposed to that. You know, we almost welcome that to a certain degree because it takes the judgment out of our hands. But as Gary mentioned, you know, some QFs would say, hey, I want it to be 6 months because they want to clear everybody out of the queue in front of them. And others would say, well, wait a second, I want it to be a year because I've got a good queue spot and I want to try to complete my project.
Right, and I think we all understand that balancing act. And I think we all understand those things, but I just think that maybe we haven't understood all of these details, which is why we wanted this technical conference, because from our vantage point, it hasn't seemed to be consistent. So we just, that's, I think, one of the reasons we wanted to understand your process better.
And that's a good segue, Michelle, just to kind of make it clear that, you know, the purpose of this technical conference is just to understand the process better. Ultimately, parties will have the opportunity, as we'll discuss in January, about, you know, filing proposals, talking about the merits. I just want to make sure we're kind of, I know we've been kind of going a little bit further in terms of talking about merits. I just want to be careful, especially since we have commissioners here. So just
appreciate that reminder. And, you know, in response to your comment, Michelle, probably where you see some disparity is the length of the negotiation process is typically where we see some variance in timing. You know, some will come in and negotiate the PPA very quickly, and others it may take several months for whatever reason. So that's where we see a lot of variance is in that negotiation timeline.
And it really depends on who the QF is. You know, you have some who are, you know, more small scale developers versus the larger developers that have put projects forward. Those generally already have their legal teams lined up, their analysts in place. All the smaller shops have to kind of farm that out and develop. So it, you know, and I think what we've always also tried to do is balance the management of this against, you know, our PERB obligation and, you know, not be viewed as in some way discriminating amongst them by pulling them out of the queue at some point. We want to ensure that it's understood that we do have the obligation to buy from them, but we can't hold a spot indefinite for them.
It kind of raises maybe, well, How long can do you have a sense, or can you describe what your thought process might be if a developer gets into the queue and every 3 months you contact them and they say, yes, we want to stay in the queue. We're working on this or that or the other thing. But how many three-month periods can go by before you start to question whether something is really going to happen or not? I mean, it seems like there should be some limit to how long they can stay in the queue, even if they are in some way communicating with you.
Is that the 9 months?
Well, it is. It is, and it isn't. I mean, I think if they, you know, part of them, we call them up or we send them an email and they say, yeah, keep me in the queue, that answer is not good enough. You know, it's like, okay, you can stay in the queue, but what are you doing? Mm-hmm. Document, provide documentation, or something. And usually then what you have is a conversation with that QF, either written or on the phone, where they say, well, here's what I've done in the last 3 months. You know, I'm in the interconnection queue. I'm waiting for costs to come out of my system impact study, which will affect my economics. I think that's a reasonable request.
A reasonable response.
Yeah. Okay. If it's one where they say, well, yeah, I just haven't gotten around to it, that's a whole different response. You know, that to me says, okay, you're kind of kind of got a yellow flag going up here that you're just trying to hold a spot there for now. So,
you know, how would you treat that?
Well, I would just say, look, we need to provide me some documentation of progress. You know, we can't hold you indefinitely in the queue. As it is, when you come back, your prices are now stale. You would get new prices. So it is a kind of a discussion with them relative to what's their due diligence on the project.
So after two or three times of that,
we'll say, well, we're not seeing any progress. We're going to take you out of the queue for now. And that has happened. And they're like, yeah, that's probably reasonable. But rarely do we have the ones who go the 9 months. And part of what you can see, and really lately what you saw in this last year with all these projects coming in, was there's an artificial cliff sitting out there with the investment tax credit. There's usually some external driver that is... which establishes why there's a big rush of projects coming in. And the ITC for solar projects, both here in Utah and also in Oregon, was a huge driver. So,
what we do, a little follow-up on the
person. Sure.
What we found in general, before we get to that, Justin, is that if we give them a price and the price works, they want to move ahead in the process and sign a contract. If we give them a price and the price doesn't work, then they don't really care if they drop out of the queue. It's what we've kind of found in general practice. So it's not like, hey, I've got this great price, I want to hold on to it for a year and a half because I'm going to do a project. If they've got a price and it works, they move ahead.
My question was, do you have a point where you see, I see a lot of these on here, wind projects in these state boards, unsigned that are expected to go online some about 10 or 11 months from now. And if you ever look at those and say, the probability of that happening is so close to zero that we can just bump them out because the odds of them signing a PPA and reaching a viable project online in October of 2015 is just such a low probability.
Well, I understand your point, and certainly we look at that, but that's their decision. It's their business model. I can't pull them out because I believe their business model is wrong.
Okay. So these you would wait till, I guess, on number one, for example, October 1st before you remove them?
Oh, you mean their start date, if that was their start date?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you would never get that far along without it being in contract negotiations or something like that. And they may come back and say, you know, we can make this project work without the PTC, or the PTC has been extended, and so we're going to change the date. Okay, changing your date, we're going to move you back to the beginning of the line.
We do that when they submit the pricing request. If it's a greenfield project and they say my online date's next week, we say, well, that's not reasonable.
Right.
And you need to fix that. But some of these can be a little deceiving because it might be an existing project. It's a contract that's expiring.
Okay.
And so they're just extending their contract. So their start date might be 4 months away, but they're already built. And so
yeah,
some
are,
of those are a little deceiving.
There are a few of those in this.
Okay.
Yeah.
So these are not all.
Yeah, for example, number 18 is an existing project that their other contracts expiring.
That's just an extension.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I have a few questions, Bruce. Just some things I want to clarify that I understand correctly, or some I just don't have a clue. First of all, these deferrable resources, 2027. If one were to pull out of the IRP update those QF projects that are signed but not yet built, would that move that back to 2024? Or do you know what that would be? Maybe Brian? So it didn't move back, right? You'd have an earlier deferrable date if you took those out, right? So the list here doesn't include those that contribute. There's at least three or four.
Right.
Signed QFs that contribute, they're in the IRP, therefore not listed here, but that still affect the Q position, right?
Just before we go on to the next question, maybe we'll go over to Rick, but like if you take Blue Mountain and Latigo out of the IRP, a 18 gas plant is not going to pop up suddenly.
No, you're right.
And I would add kind of the earlier part of the workshop today, the capacity contribution in the IRP update, we hadn't done the study yet.
Right.
So for a wind project, it's 4%. So even if it's a 100 megawatt project, it's contributing
4%
to your load and resource balance. It's not going to really have a material impact on your time.
Okay, thank you.
Picture.
And then secondly, so we have this list, we have the three or four signed ones that aren't on the list, the 16 signed ones that are. Let's say I'm, you know, pick a number 12 on the queue list of unsigned ones.
Okay.
And tomorrow, we reach terms, and I'm ready to sign the PPA. Sign the PPA, hand it back to you. Let's assume that it's been long enough you decide to reprice. Now, I don't know that that always happens, but let's assume you reprice just before I sign, hopefully not after. What is assumed in terms of queue position? Do you still assume projects 1 through 11 on the potential list will be built so it doesn't move me up in the queue even though I'm not ready to sign?
Correct.
So some of these up here with signed positions 1 through 16 and the 3 or 4 that are in the IRP may not have, those, that isn't necessarily their queue position. They may have been priced as though they were Q20 or Q25 or something. Have you ever given thought to a process that when someone's ready to sign, and I'm going to do a caveat here, sign may not be the right mile point
mm-hmm.
because the real dollars come some point after one signs, right? Posting security. Posting the money with PacTran to do the interconnection studies, et cetera. But have you ever given thought to a process that would say, when you're ready to do something that commits you more completely than just saying we're interested, you rerun it and move them up to the top of the queue of unsigned and or uncommitted projects? Have you ever given any thought to that kind of a process?
I haven't, but I'd look to these two guys to talk about, you know, how does that
yeah, I think Gary, if you were the number one in the queue at that
you'd
point,
hate it.
You'd hate it.
So I say, I'm not speaking for a client per se, because I've got them all over on this, but it seems like a process point. There ought to be some way to weed out those that are really not going to happen, and give the benefit to those that really could happen with the right pricing. And I don't know quite what that is. And again, I probably can't even weigh in because my funds will be all over the
board. Challenge to that approach, too, might be that you have to reprice the entire Q project by project, one after the other, because their positions just got...
It would affect everybody.
So it's like any time someone gets to that stage, you're repricing every project in the Q at that point in time as well. And I think that's there's a lot of controversy and challenge.
I mean, the concept that I'm, again, exploring is a notion that really the indicative pricing doesn't give you a number because it is subject to being updated. At least in my experience, most projects take months to get from indicative pricing to signed PPA, right? And the pricing is likely to change at least once during that period that you'll update it. So to me, indicative pricing is a range. You know, it could be 10% less, it could be 10% more, although, you know, yeah, potentially more. And so I think most developers probably know that and probably say, you know, we're within the range. You know, let's move forward. It's worth spending our, you know, development capital, time, energy, and professionals and the like to get to take the next step. But it seems like it would be useful if at some point there were a way to realistically reevaluate those that now are prepared to commit and move forward, get pricing that, as though they are the next one in the queue to be built, because maybe they will be, as opposed to having these dozens of queue positions that may never move anywhere, reducing their pricing. Again, I don't have a proposal. I don't know if I can, but just kind of as an observer, that's always frustrating me, that the queue is so long. And I'll point out, and I won't get into things that are before the commission, but this queue also affects the Schedule 37 pricing, right? Isn't it a 10 megawatt load kind of at the end of the queue?
50?
Or 50 megawatt.
Correct, but the queue is not a part of Schedule 37.
Yeah. Where do you put that in there?
The front of the line.
Okay, I misunderstood that.
Is that the front of the line after the signed contracts? Or is it? Do you recall?
That's a good question. I'd have to confirm. I think it is after the signed contracts, but with the caveat that the commission has determined that the avoided capacity costs begin with that first deferrable resource.
And is that
in the IRP?
From the IRP,
right?
Not from this
correct.
Queue.
Correct. Okay.
Yeah. See, that's maybe where I misunderstood.
Yeah.
It does raise this question, though, because there's an informal pool about which ones of those actual signed QS we have right now.
That'll get built?
That will actually get built. And so signing a contract doesn't...
I agree with that. Yeah. Signing doesn't necessarily do it. You spend a reasonable amount of money to that point, but not the big bucks. Right. The big bucks come with interconnection commitments and with security deposits and the like. And that's when a project becomes, in my mind, real.
Right, when they put some money into it. Yeah, right. Put down their development security. Absolutely.
But at that point, would they have already gone to a bank to look for financing and based on the indicative pricing determine that even though they're number 7 on the queue and not getting the best pricing, that project is viable at number 7 based on the feedback they get from the financing, right?
Right. I think he was talking more about the executed ones that were, whether they...
But I take your point. In other words, if people put that kind of real money down, they've concluded it's financeable.
Yeah, where they've taken
one
step on
it. Or they're willing to put a lot of money down at risk if they haven't.
Yeah.
But... more of these, my point is more would get built if they can get realistic pricing at the time they're ready to put the box down and move forward, if there were a way to do that.
And that's
one
of the things I always try to do, Gary, is we file a quarterly compliance filing which shows where the indicative price is, more or less, for the different resource types. And I try to, those guys who call up for the first time and say, hey, where are QF prices for solar? Quarterly compliance filing is a great place to look to say, oh, it's about 4 cents, 5 cents, 3 cents, whatever it is. And they can say, oh, well, that's close to what might work for my project. I want to put in a pricing request. If they say, well, geez, I need 12 cents and the price is 3 cents, then they know. And so we try to use the quarterly compliance filing as like, hey, do you want to dive into this process or not? And then what we found is You know, a lot of times we give them a price. If it works, boom, they want to move ahead. Okay. In fact, we can't move fast enough often when they get a price that works for them. They want a PPA, they want to negotiate, they want to move forward right away.
At that price.
I think part of our concern, though, is if you take this 16, and there are some on there, I agree that I've got there, we're going to kill. But they're holding a place in the queue because they have a signed PPA. And there may be one of these unsigned QFs closer to the top here that if they had just a little bit better price, they could make a go of it. And they might be a more viable project in terms of actually getting to a completed project and online date. And that's the dilemma or the issue that we've raised in the past, and kind of in a nutshell.
Yeah, and maybe some of the PPA milestones that we haven't got to that we're towards the end here might help show how we manage that.
I guess we will let you go through the
this is good stuff.
So we can always come back to the queue, but the other item that folks wanted to talk about was the power purchase agreement milestones. And I could have listed every single milestone we have in there, but I chose not to do that. More importantly, I just wanted to try to talk about milestones and why we have them. We have them in there, and I think the QF would agree that they're really in place to eliminate any ambiguity during development, construction, and operation of the project. We have, with all of our agreements, no matter what state that we're in, we have tried to have similar milestones from a verbiage standpoint that a QF can know they have to meet, and things that the company has to do in order for that project to come online and stay online, and there's a good exchange of information between them on schedules, on the operation of the project. We also, including in that, try to establish what the deliverables are for that milestone. And likewise, what are the consequences if you don't meet the milestones? So if you really look at our milestones, and not all of them have them, but for the most part, if it's a significant one, it could be an event of default within a cure period, liquidated damages for not meeting it, and possible termination. Those are the real big critical milestones for us. We have them, in, like I said, in all of our PPAs, whether it's a Schedule 37 or a 38. They vary a little bit sometimes based on the technology type. For example, a wind which has a availability requirement and milestones to meet for that, and has a different construction schedule, will be slightly different than a solar one. They're not meant to be punitive. They're just meant really to establish a reasonable, consistent expectation between the company to make sure we're in line with our business practices, any commission orders, and kind of industry practices. And some of the milestones aren't negotiable. To be deemed commercial, they've got to deliver certain items. And, until they deliver those items to our satisfaction, they're not deemed commercial to receive the full contract price. So, we've got a fairly significant number of milestones in it. I understand really from, I think, some of the comments I've seen from the DPU and others is that some of these milestones seem maybe a little too long in duration for the project to go from when it's approved by the commission until the project is COD. But I think what we've always tried to do in there is have the consistent milestone in there, regardless of how long it takes to build the project, but make sure it addresses that project's schedule to get built. One of the things we do relative to some of those milestones is they're required to provide kind of a project schedule from construction to online, and we kind of use that to frame up some of the dates and everything for meeting milestones. So,
what kind of milestones are negotiable?
Are negotiable? Generally, it's within a. It would be the timing, how long you have. We've got a kind of a set date in there for example, our standard is 30 days after the contract's executed and approved by the commission, then they have to provide their project development security. We've provided some that allow it to be delivered in two batches, 25-50% at 30 days, and then 50% or the other remaining percent at some point down the road. That's an example of it. It's really not the milestone itself, it's more the dates and stuff that are enough.
Like a signed interconnection agreement. Sometimes we need a signed interconnection, so we look at where they're at in the process, and if we know they're going to have a signed interconnection agreement, we can see on OASIS and they provide a documentation that we expect them to have one 45 days later, we'd put a milestone in the PPA around that. What's a challenge is, we try to use good commercial judgment and, again, balance on all these items. We wouldn't be opposed to more strict deadlines. It's just that becomes an additional challenge, because if we say it's 30 days that you have to post your security, and then you're using a Spanish bank and it's a Spanish holiday and it becomes 35 days, well, then do we terminate the PPA and they go back to the back of the queue and we go through the whole process all over again? It's, where do we strike the balance between...
It's a punishment for not using an American bank.
So that's where we try to use good commercial judgment on these things to work with the QF, but at the same time protect other customers from harm if the QF defaults. That's really the balancing act here.
And I think we found the toughest milestones for them generally are getting financing, meeting the original interconnection schedule, because the interconnection schedule we're finding changes every time they go back in to do a study. The transmission side of the business construction or getting a long lead item may extend it out. And one of the things we do there is we have a kind of a joint discussion with transmission and the QF to understand the schedule. Schedule is very critical, because that's usually the thing that takes the longest to get the project online. So we require, if they can't provide us a executed interconnection agreement, we generally require a letter from Pacific Core Transmission or some documentation from them that says their interconnection can meet the commercial online date that's in the power purchase agreement. So we've tried to find alternatives to provide at least a little bit of commercial flexibility if things change. But we also have tried to establish, here's things that if you can't deliver the interconnection agreement, the least you can get is a letter from the PAC Trans that says, yeah, I can meet the schedule to be out commercially online. It's not a reasonable schedule. So,
well, our understanding is that developer has to put up a considerable amount of money to get studies done and the interconnection agreement And we've kind of viewed that as being one of the indications that the project is real. And as we've discussed earlier, our concern has been that it's relatively easy to get a PPA, per se, in terms of the amount of money that a developer has to put up. But it's when they have to start putting down some real money that's when you can get an indication of whether it's a real project or not. And so I guess you mentioned earlier about the length of time after they sign a PPA, and presumably in a couple months they'll get commission approval. But I guess our concern again gets back to the idea that if they're not going to be a real project, we don't want them continuing to hold a position in the queue for 9 months or 12 months or something like that. I mean, that's the bottom line, or that's our bottom line there, our concerns.
And I think we have, I think there's probably, some ways to look at the indicative pricing process and find maybe some ways to improve that or tighten it up. Once the agreement's executed and approved, I think the milestones that we've negotiated generally have enough teeth behind them. If they don't meet those, for the project to either, standard cure period of generally 90 days to 120 days to cure. If that's not met, then, the company has the option to terminate the agreement. Those are generally, I think, significant teeth in them for, at least from what the QF community and some of their lenders have said, that those are incentive enough for them to stay on track with their project. And, we have had projects that have been terminated. We have had projects that have, basically terminated themselves because they realize they can't get a specific permit for their wind project or whatever. So I think that those are really the milestones with the right teeth behind them are good incentives on both sides to continue to get the project done.
What about the back end? Just to make an extreme example, I don't think the division would support a PPA with an online date in 2025.
That would be extreme.
Yeah.
That was my project.
The projects that we've seen come forward last few years, it gets a little bit more difficult to say, well, should we say that they can't be any farther out than 2.5 years? Or should we go all the way to 3 years? In some projects, obviously, at least claim that they can get that in 24 months. So somewhere between 24 months and 36 months has struck us as being kind of a gray area, perhaps. But nevertheless, we want to be able to give a developer enough time to do the job. But on the other hand, we want to keep moving forward with some sense of urgency.
Yeah, no, I understand. And I would say, that 24 to 36 months period is one that, we're consistently hearing as, a reasonable amount of time. And partly because as you begin to look at the interconnection process, with the amount of projects that are coming online or actually in getting equipment's getting bought for and built, that the lead time for transformers has been out there. You know, it used to be that PacTrans would say, you know, we can interconnect your project and from, you know, start to finish in 20 months. They're now out at 30 months. You know, their oats says 24, but they're pushing 30 just because of long lead time with equipment. So I think we have to kind of look at that and say, all right, well, come to me with, you know, your connection study's already been done, or recognize that there is a long period of time for them just to get the, if they both start them at here, our PPA is done here, but the interconnection's not, and the project's not ready for here. Solar project will be built in months. I mean, they put those things up really quickly. It's interconnecting it. It's the long lead time.
Well, even wind projects seem to be able to be done
very quickly
on the building season. Right. So. Yeah.
Well, the construction of the project itself, it's again back to the interconnection is usually the critical path. I don't know.
Well, that's what I was saying. The construction of the project itself seems to be done within about 6 months.
I think the only ones that I've seen that see that 36 months is too short are geothermal projects. I mean, just because of the nature of securing the you know, the hot water steam for those projects, those are just a very, you know, capital construction intense business, and they generally say I'm like at 48 months type of thing. But we don't really get a lot of geothermal projects.
In our general practice, Chuck, has been if your online date is 5 years further or more than when you request pricing, we typically say, well, we're not going to give you pricing for a project that's not going to start for more than 5 years. And if your online date is more than 3 years from when we sign the PPA, we typically don't want to do that either. So those are kind of rough guidelines that we've used. Now, there's nothing in Schedule 38 that says you can't ask for a price that's 7 years out. And so, again, there's where you have to use some good commercial judgment. But that's been our general rule of thumb, is 5 years for pricing, 3 years for signing the PPA.
Well, we don't want to be completely inflexible, be reasonable about it, but I guess as you might guess, our expectations are the closer in time, the better. That's our general rule of thumb.
And we would agree with you on that. But then on the other side of the coin is the what's reasonable to get in you know, current times to get a project done. And if they can show us a project schedule and you know, information from the transmission side of the business that, yeah, it's going to take us 30 months, and that there's a queue to get, you know, panels or wind turbines, you know, that's that far out, then I think that evidence provides a little bit of flexibility around it, but our general is to get it on and get the project COD as soon as possible after the execution of the agreement.
So what you're telling me is when you bring a contract forward to the commission for approval, you should have documentation that would support, say, a 36-month online date for a project that previously might have only taken 24 months because of interconnection difficulties that are beyond the party's control.
And a lot of that's, you know, we're seeing with the solar. We generally get project schedule from the developer as part of the work we do with them.
Well, I understand you can't get it directly from PacTrans unless you
Well, we do. So what we'll do in that case is we'll either have a joint call or meeting with transmission. We, in all cases, will get a waiver from the QF so we can have those kind of discussions, and that gets posted on OASIS. So, you know, we want to be careful about not getting some sort of FERC violation. But
there's other things that come into play besides interconnection, like whether on BLM land or not. That could extend the development time. If you were to ask the QF developers, how long does it take you to get financing? You're going to hear 2 months, 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. And so the financing window is different for everyone.
Yeah.
So it's a little hard to say you can build a solar project. If you start today, it'll take you 23 months. So again, that's where we try to use some commercial judgment.
Well, no, I don't know. I mean, some of these things, like they decide to build on BLM land as opposed to try to find a private landowner that'll lease in the land. That seems to be a business decision that's made at the developer's level. And
check how much of the land is BLM land in Utah. You don't have many options off of BLM land. It's either Forest Service, BLM, state, SITLA land, or 2% is private, right?
It's a building you saw as a business decision. I mean,
yeah, but this is only Utah that we're dealing with.
Well, I know, but
I'm just saying, I don't think you can kind of say we should discriminate against those that choose BLM. They have no options.
Well, there are options.
There really are.
Well, we just signed PPAs off.
Well, there aren't options. You have to have a good site. If you're going to build a wind plant, wind's got to blow, right? If it's going to be a solar site, the sun's got to shine. And you've got to have hundreds and hundreds of acres. You tell me where you'd go.
Well, there's been companies that have found those places.
I represented a lot of them. I'm telling you, most of them end up on BLM land, at least affecting BLM or forest or some federal land. You can't spit in the state without hitting federal something.
Rich is the congressman that wants to have them give it all back to the state.
Well, that could happen. I don't know. But I'm just saying, in this state, you just assume you can have some federal impact almost anywhere you do
it. Well, but there's still a lot of business decisions made by the developers that we shouldn't be concerned about. That's all I'm saying.
Well, if you want to ignore your obligation to promote the development of QFs, yes.
Well, that's where we really try to balance those things. And again, we don't want to argue the merits of one thing or another. That's just been our practice, is that balance. And
right.
I feel like we strike it because I've been on the witness stand, me personally, saying that our milestones are, you know, arguing that our milestones are strict enough and arguing that they're too strict. Both sides. We've been accused of both. So we probably have done a pretty decent job of striking that balance.
Irritating everybody.
Yeah. Now, at the same time, again, these, as we talked about, Schedule 38 has very specific provisions that the company must follow per tariff. You know, a lot of what we've talked about here with the milestones and other things are not necessarily in the tariff, but they're what we've done in good business practice, and that's what we've explained today.
And, you know, the part of that is a lot of the milestones in the QF agreements are consistent with the ones we use if we're doing an RFP for a new resource, for a new renewable resource. So, you know, I think that has provided some consistency kind of across the spectrum of project types.
And again, you know, I think all these questions are great, but, you know, one thing, too, you might want to consider, and again, I can't direct folks here to discuss further, but at some point, you know, maybe if we're kind of done with the kind of question and answer kind of type of conference, if you want, you know, out the room, do you want to, you know, have staff leave and talk about, you know, proposals or whatever? I mean, you know, just kind of throwing that out there, but I don't want to chill. These are good questions. This is a good discussion, but...
Can you clarify a little more how the interconnection milestone is set? Is it are there company guidelines? You know, the milestone after the PPA is signed, that date when they have to have an interconnection agreement, or is that negotiated with the developer based on their individual circumstance?
Well, the milestone itself is generally very simple. They have to deliver a executed interconnection agreement, and it usually has some date that it aligns up with. Certainly has to be before they reach COD.
That's what I'm getting at. How far out is that date set? Is it just dependent on the progress that the developer has made at the time of PPA signing, or is there some set window that you're shooting for just to show that they're actually serious about the project?
So we always try to, you know, the interconnection process is in the Pacific Core Transmission's tariff, their OAT. And you can go in there, and it has very specifically their milestones that once you put an application in, then X period of time later, you know, we would be able to interconnect. What happens, though, is in between here is the developer may step away because he has certain times to, he has a certain timeline where if he doesn't go to the next step, he goes out of the queue. So theirs is really a very prescribed process. And usually that next step is putting down another piece of cash to do another study or at some point it's a deposit to begin and to meet the construction schedule. So what we've always found is, you know, we try to look at the OAT, we try to see where they are in the process of the interconnection. If they're just starting interconnection, we know it's still at least 24 months away. If they're in the system impact study, you can actually look at the impact study, and it'll tell you, you know, at that point how many more months it is before construction would be done. So we utilize the kind of the known available information to us through either the OAT or that as the kind of the milestones. Our critical thing is we don't want to have execute the PPA with a COD of June of 2016 and then get an interconnection agreement that says, oh, it's December 31st, 2016. That's not going to work well for the QF, because within that period of time, you know, you'd have the right to terminate them. So we're trying to get out ahead of those kind of circumstances where we don't get into some sort of dispute with the QF over schedule.
And the interconnection process is very prescribed. You start with the feasibility study, which is a high-level look as to whether you can interconnect in that location. That's a low-cost, high-level look. If you want to move forward, you move to what's called a system impact study, and that's kind of the key one. A system impact study will come back and say, your interconnection cost is going to be X, and your online date can be any time after Y. And that system impact study is really a key document that we need to have, because with that, a QF can say, well, I know my interconnection cost, and I know when my online date can be. So we have to have that at a minimum. The next stage they move to is a facility study, and that's where PAC Transmission says, okay, of that $10 million, you need this Mitsubishi transformer. I'm going to go get right-of-way across this property, and they actually go and do a detailed plan and say, okay, here's my construction plans and everything you've picked out for this, and sign on the line your interconnection agreement, and we'll go do it.
And in that step, sometimes the dates they gave you in the second step change, and so does the dollars.
Right.
Yes.
That's part of the complication that you're talking about. And they answer to no one.
And we typically, with the system impact study,
they can change those at the last minute.
It's not common for them to change dramatically. That's why the system impact study, we feel pretty good about continuing to move forward. But a facility study is supposed to take, I think, 90 days after that. So if you have a system impact study in hand and you're in the process of facility study, we'll say you need a signed interconnection agreement within the next 100 days as a milestone of the PPA.
Or 120 days.
Yeah, whatever it may be. But we need, you got to have at least a system impact study to say you can come online by a certain date. That's kind of been our, because you have to put a lot of money down. By the time you do those three phases, you're probably $50,000 to $100,000 potentially.
I mean, the interconnection, they won't even start until you give them 10 grand, typically 10 grand as a debt deposit to do anything.
But our practice has been we won't sign a PPA until we have at least the system impact study that says you can be online by this date. That's been our practice.
Maybe that's what we should use for queue management. Deposit.
10 grand.
10 grand.
So I think it might be helpful, Jordan. I mean, if parties are amenable to talking for a few minutes about path forward,
we're happy to, kind of conclude the tech conference if you guys want to have the room for a while. And
at least the last 5 minutes.
What's up?
Maybe let me ask a question, because since we were talking about the interconnection agreement, if I remember correctly, Schedule 38 allows company at their discretion to require an interconnection agreement before they will execute a PPA. Is that really a reasonable requirement that the company could impose on the QF? It's out there, but is it really a reasonable?
It's hard to enforce it.
You have to argue the merits of what's reasonable, I suppose. So.
We should hold that discussion.
Yeah, we're.
Yeah. I have a comment on that.
Do you have further?
Yes. Maybe before we go offline, I think one of the next technical conferences, if not the next, is about grid modeling. And I'm not sure what that means or what folks are interested in particularly. I'm assuming that I'm going to have to be involved in that one, so I'm interested.
Really?
So I was just interested in what people
thought. Sarah, weren't you going to get
Yeah, this is me, and I haven't done my homework yet.
Okay.
So part of what I'd like to better understand is how the different inputs, I know you have a bunch of different inputs and how they impact the pricing. And I just need to talk to a consultant about it for a little bit before I get back to you, and I have been not able to do that yet.
So it sounds like,
scheduled?
I think it's January 6th. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like that you're going to work informally with the company. There's not going to be additional questions, or did you want to do that?
I'm happy. I mean, if you want to just
maybe I'll just send them to the group that's interested.
Well, Brian, if I could chime in too, how you shaping would be interesting to show how that put in. I can't remember if it's the demand file or whatever the module is in the grid. That's very helpful, especially when we talk about renewable resources. And we were talking about wind this morning and how those are averaged over blocks of time. Based on my earlier question, I certainly forgot how stuff goes in the queue, for example, at QF. So
that's the shaping of intermittent resources like wind resource, how we model those.
Just explain that.
Okay.
I have a follow up question for Bruce that might be okay for the commission staff. In the PPAs that we have seen the last couple of years, this milestone of a signed interconnection agreement has kind of jumped around, from like 30 or 60 days to 9 months. Could you explain why we see this variability in setting the milestone?
I think, and Paul kind of talked to it,
you know, we want some certainty around the schedule, and if they're not going to, if they're just starting their interconnection agreement, won't have their system impact study for 6 months or so, it makes sense to have the something delivered after that. If they've already got their system impact study and they know that they're going to execute their interconnection agreement in 3 months, then we look to that. We try to line up, you know, and that's kind of the critical thing, is to line up when we have really concrete information coming out of transmission that would line up with when the COD and the kind of the backfeed is completed by PacTrans. Our preference is always shorter, but we also realize that sometimes, for example, we've had some that are in a very complicated area, and they're a queue with a whole bunch of projects in front of them, so transmission does it, you know, sequentially also. So their time to get to it, and their time to study it, may take them 6 months to do that before you have really some good information.
Well, by saying you had some real good information, you still feel like you had good enough information to do a PPA?
Yeah, I think, you know, part of that is having, during the negotiations, is having the conversations with ourselves, the QF, and PacTrans. Because they can talk to the time it takes, and they can give you the kind of the outlying times. But, you know, certainly you want documentation to do that. And I think, you know, frankly, we have to also be reflective of our, you know, PURPA obligation not to discriminate about what they can. What their rights are, and we certainly have to have the evidence that they can interconnect with us, balanced against what's reasonable, a reasonable time frame to bring it on.
And the variation mostly has come from where they're at in the facility study and interconnection agreement negotiation process. That could take 6-7 months. And so if we've got a system impact study and they're just starting that process, maybe we let them have the 6 months. If we know they just got the facilities study done and they're negotiating their interconnection agreement, they only need 3 months to do that. So we kind of look at where they're at in the process and say, we'll give you time to complete the process, but by then, we need it. So it's not just a number kind of picked out of the hat. And that's typically the milestone that's make or break. Like you said, these projects that are signed, you know, it's pretty rare that we'll sign a contract and its online date is 2 years out, and we're sitting there 2 years later saying, well, are you going to come on next week or not? Mm-hmm. I mean, usually they miss that first milestone and they terminate, or they self-terminate. I mean, that happens more than anything, is they kind of self-terminate.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you. I'm going to go ahead and just, I'll go grab the recorder. I'll just have someone come grab the computer stuff here, but it'd be like a